eye checker like you were seeing Bill in it, yeah? I really don't mind. You hit me once,
I hit you back. He's bowling like my Auntie Annie when she'd had too much sherry to drink. Played over my head,
then I set fire. मैंने कहा बेटा बेटा होता है और बाप बाप होता है.
Hello and welcome to Pie Checkers Cricket Podcast. I am joined by my fellow Pie Checkers, Sai from Toronto, where it's early Saturday morning, and Sumer from Germany, from a place where he's overlooking Swiss mountains and enjoying good things in life. And I'm Vivek from Pondicherry this time. Welcome, guys, to Pie Checkers Cricket Podcast.
Hello. Great to be here. Thank you.
And I'm sure you guys are as excited beyond thrilled to have a guest who is anything but a pie checker. He was number 374 to play for Australia in Test. He played 44 Tests, taking 208 wickets at a strike rate of 54, which is a wicket every 9 overs, which just to put into perspective, is better than Kumble, Vaughan, and Murli. And all of this at an average of 29. In those 44 tests, he had 9 four wicket hauls, 12 fifers, and 2 10 wicket hauls. A lot of cricket pundits felt if he was born in any other era, he would have taken 500 test wickets. Stuart McGill, it's a pleasure having you on Pie Checkers Cricket Podcast.
But now listen, gentlemen, first of all, I'm trying not to blush because you're being incredibly gracious. Thank you very, very much. You mentioned some names there, particularly Anil, and you know, he's amazing to me, and I think he's overlooked largely in the history of spin bowling. He's an amazing bowler that I use a lot in my coaching today, because I love people bowling the way they want to bowl and bowling the way that they're supposed to bowl. And he and I had a chat the other day because I sent him a happy birthday message. It was his birthday a couple of weeks ago. I'm sure he's older than me, obviously, because look at how fresh I am. But one thing that I need to correct you on, the reason and the main reason that I wanted to join you guys in your podcast, forget about the secret agent somewhere in Germany. We don't know exactly where he is, and nobody can ever know. And forget about Toronto, which is an amazing city. Forget about India. The reason I wanted to join you guys particularly is because I think if there is a podcast that suits me, it's the Pie Chucking Podcast. Because trust me, I know how to chuck a pie.
Thank you. Great to have you. Great to have you.
Thank you. So it's been, Stuart, 12 years since you retired from international cricket. How has life been for you after retiring in 2008?
Look, it's an interesting question because a lot of time now is spent on player welfare and that sort of stuff. And players from my generation and from earlier, sometimes we roll our eyes at player welfare, because one of the great aspects of cricket is that it is difficult. If you're a batsman and you make and you're playing club cricket, for example, in Sydney or in Perth or, you know, anywhere around the world, you make one mistake and you don't get another bat possibly for another 2 weeks. Cricket is an unforgiving sport. And the higher up the grades you go, the less forgiving it is. You know, one thing that you can be sure of is if you bowl a half track or a full toss to Sachin or Lakshman or Dravid, it's not going to come back very quickly. It's going all the way. When if you're playing, you know, third or fourth or fifth grade, you might get away with a short ball. you might get away with a full toss. You may even get a wicket with a full toss. And I have to say, I got wickets with full tosses in Test cricket, but it becomes less and less forgiving as the stakes get higher, I guess. So we like to think of ourselves, my generation and the generations that went before me in cricket, we like to think of ourselves as being resilient and tough and able to cope with those bad days. And when I talk to young spin bowlers now, and when I say young, I normally mean 20, probably your age. What I like to say to them is that we're both slow. Doesn't really matter how big it goes sideways. Doesn't really matter how much it drops or drifts. We're both slow. Your grandmother could hit us for six. She might not be able to do it every single ball, but she could do it once. If she tries to hit you for six every single ball, you're going to go down at some point. And so it's all about how you get up off the floor and go back to the top of your mark and repeat. It's funny, I think I've mentioned this before in other forums. Probably the worst Rocky movie of all time is Balboa, which is, I think, Rocky VI. And he says it's not about how hard you can get hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and get up and keep moving forward. And that's what it is when you're a bowler. It's not just a spin bowler. It's not just a wrist spin bowler. It's about, and you know what? It's probably not even just a bowler. It's about a cricket player. It's about if you've had a bad day or a bad week or a bad month or a bad year, if you can still turn up every week and do your business and attempt to be your best, then that's what makes you special. And so we are a pretty unforgiving mob. Consequently, to answer your question, eventually, post-cricket is a very interesting time for us. When I say us, I'm not talking about myself in the third person. I mean, for the group of cricket players, it's a very interesting time because all of the things that we've taught ourselves about resilience and about getting through things and getting over things don't apply in the real world. And you certainly can't treat people in your workplace the way that we treated people in our workplace. post-cricket is very interesting. I've had a bunch of different jobs. At the moment, I'm trying to punish myself even more than I punished myself when I was playing cricket being involved in a restaurant. And trust me, anybody who's ever worked in hospitality, it's a lot easier when you're 20 than it is when you're 50.
Interesting.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I think there were some great life lessons over there. Going back, Stuart, to where it all started, we can say that cricket was in your family. Like your grandfather and father played first class cricket. Your grandfather kind of bowled to Don Bradman and got him out as well. Your father was good friends with Dennis Lilly. And you have mentioned that Dennis Lilly played a huge role in you becoming a cricketer, but he inspired you to become a fast bowler. But then you turned out to be one of the biggest leg spinners for Australia. How did that happen? How was that whole journey? Or what was that whole journey all about?
Well, look, you rightly said, my grandfather and my father played first class cricket for Western Australia. My grandfather did. He opened the batting and bowling for Western Australia either side of the Second World War, so long, long, long time ago. He played a game against Bradman, opening the batting and bowling, knocked Bradman off in the first innings, I think. I think it was actually straggled down the leg side, but we won't talk about that. And also, one of the most exciting things about my grandfather is that there's a book that was released in Australia a bunch of years ago called Chuckers, and Grandpa's in it. So that's even better. It's almost like having a convict in the family. In terms of street cred, my grandpa was a chucker. So, but Bradman, in the same game, Grandpa made 75 or something like that, opening the batting. 4 for 74 and then 75 or 80 opening the batting, did a good job. Bradman asked him to move to South Australia from Western Australia to play with him, but had a young family, so he stayed there. And also, I think, because this was after the Second World War, and from all reports, Grandpa's best years were behind him. And so he, maybe in the back of his head, he kind of knew that. But on the day of my first test match, which was against South Australia in, South Africa, I'm sorry, in South Australia, at the Adelaide Oval, my parents and I went out for dinner. We just picked a restaurant randomly. And we were sitting down for dinner, just the three of us. And my father said to me halfway through dinner, "That's Don Bradman." And he pointed at another table, and Bradman was eating at the in the restaurant with a very good friend of mine, Basil Sellers, great guy. And I looked across and thought, yeah, that's Bradman. But I thought I was a little bit too cool, and I didn't want to go and say hello to him. because I didn't want to interrupt him or be a dickhead. apologies. But that's exactly what I didn't want to do, you know. And then we kept eating. I didn't go and say hello. Then he left the restaurant. And as he was leaving the restaurant, I'm going, well, it doesn't really matter anyway because I haven't bothered him, so I'll just leave him alone. And then I just thought, you know what, Stuart? You get one opportunity. It's the first day of your first test match. You know who the man is. It would be completely inappropriate for you to not go and speak with him. So I chased him out of the restaurant. And like literally, so because the length of time that it's taken me to tell you this story is pretty much the same length of time. So the guy stood up, walked out of the restaurant, and I'm sitting there arguing with myself, thinking, okay, cool, should I? No, no, no. You're too cool, Stuart. Don't worry about it. And then I went, you know what? Don't be a dick. And I chased him out of the restaurant, ran out of the restaurant, and I said, I'm really sorry to... tapped him on the shoulder. I'm really, really sorry to bother you. My name is Stuart McGill and I played. Today is the first day of my test career. And he said to me, I know who you are, son. My goodness, your grandfather could play. That's what he said without a shadow of a lie. He said, I know who you are, son. Oh, yeah, I missed it. I know who you are, son. Well bowled today. My goodness, your grandfather could play. And then what was even funnier, my dad chased me out of the restaurant. And Sir Donald said, so he chased me out. And Sir Donald said to me, like, so he said that to me. And he said, oh, hi, Terry. How are you going? And I'm kind of going, what is going on here? And so this is a guy who was probably So I played it. So it was 1980, probably. I think he died in maybe 2002. He was an old man. He remembered me. He remembered my grandfather, which I love. I love people who, because my family, whilst they played first-class cricket, they didn't do anything spectacular to speak of. But I love respect, and I hate it when people say, I played against your dad. He was rubbish. Your grandfather, look, he didn't, he played four games I don't see the point of that sort of stuff. And this guy, 99.96 or 94 or whatever it was, because I'm old and I forget this stuff, but like the greatest player that Australia has ever seen, certainly. And he remembered my grandfather and my father, and he showed them both respect. And I think that's what makes me tingle to this day. It was special. And my family was a cricket family. But cricket is a family sport. And you mentioned Dennis Lilly. I tell you Bradman's story, but, we've got to go back to Dennis, because you're right. The only reason that I play cricket is because of Dennis Lilly. My dad was best mates with Dennis, and that they still hang out, which, it's funny because I love Dennis Lilly so much that I used to draw pictures of him. I knew how to do his autograph. Every time we'd go to his house, he always used to put a song on for me. It was a Neil Diamond song, which, this is early 70s, early mid 70s. Very, very daggy, dorky song. Like, certainly not a cool song, let's put it that way. But he always used to put it on for me. Whenever I left his house, he used to give me a present. Might have been a photograph, might have been a pair of gloves. Might have been, he gave me bat. He gave me, when I went to the Wacker to watch Western Australia or Australia play, he used to get me up on into the changing rooms. He used to like wave to me and say, come up. Like, and imagine as a little boy, like 6, 7, 8 years old, Dennis Lilly is waving to you, calling you up into the changing rooms. And then he'd like say to the room attendants or to the other players, look, listen, back off, man, that's Stewie. Like, it's like, it was amazing. And so I wanted to be him because he was playing for Australia and he was at the pinnacle. And at that stage in the 70s, Australian kids wanted to be the West Indians, because they were the cool ones. But for me, the coolest of the cool ones, and I knew that he got respect from the best in the world, including the West Indians, the coolest of the cool was Dennis Lilly. And I always wanted to be him. And when I'm done, Dennis Lilly will be the reason that I played cricket. He complimented my family. When I say complimented, I mean in a complimentary fashion. He added to everything that my family gave to me. And, I owe him a lot. I owe him a test career.
That's cool.
I guess you're being too modest over there.
It's true, man. It's true. I owe him my test career. When I got to 100 wickets, I was in the West Indies. And I don't remember how many tests exactly it was, maybe 21 or let's say 21 tests. There's a guy called Clary Grimmett who was a wrist spinner in the 30s and 40s in Australia. He got there in something just stupid like 17 or 18 tests. But Dennis got there in 23. And so I'd nailed him. And so I called my dad I called my dad and I said, ask Dennis how many tests it took him to get to 100 test wickets. And Dennis phoned my room in the Caribbean. I think I was maybe in Trinidad or something like that, and just left a message. We didn't speak, it was just a message. And the message was, ask Stuart how many tests it took him to get to 300. And I never got there.
So from a fast bowler, you wanting to be a fast bowler, to turning out to be one of the legends of Australia, if not the world, how did that happen, from a transformation from aspiring to be a fast bowler to a leg spinner?
Well, look, I think maybe that's one of the things that Shane and I do have in common. The two of us, we, for a period of time there, spin bowlers were the last picked in the playground. You know, God, okay, I'll pick Stewie. You know, the skinny ones or the weak ones or whatever it was. But Shane and I were both very determined and very focused and very aggressive in terms of what we wanted to achieve. So in that respect, I guess we were fast bowlers. The reason I didn't end up a fast bowler is because I couldn't bowl fast. It was pretty simple, to be honest. Even up to the age of about 13 or 14, I tried to do both. But I used to say it was because I wasn't tall enough. But when you look at guys like Harold Larwood and, you know, I mean, Ajita Gaka, you know, like, you don't have to be 6'10" to bowl fast. But I just couldn't do it. And my father was a leg spinner, a wrist spinner. He didn't really turn the ball a whole lot, but he was very disciplined and process-driven, which probably helped me in the long run. But I think even to this day, I'd much rather be a fast bowler. The only thing that's good about being a wrist spin bowler is, as I said before, your grandma can hit you for six, but if you get a guy out, imagine how humiliating it is for him. And so humiliation is quite a big part of what my generation of cricketers did. And nowadays it's called bullying, but I liked being a bully.
Interesting. I think that is something, if I look across you, Vaughan and Kumble, you all three are like ultra aggressive, competitive. And as you mentioned, you have like a fast bowler's mentality. You guys are like, if I have to say, like always angry, like the Hulk, at least on the cricket field, off the field, you guys, I'm sure, I know you are one of the nicest blokes. I've
heard
a lot of stories.
I'm very bad.
So what is that? I mean, why are all leg spinners like kind of really, really competitive, or for the lack of a better word?
Look, I think the biggest thing that when you're trying to do something that is particularly challenging. So for a wrist spinner, whether you're right arm or left arm, you throw all of your weight straight at the target, which is the batsman. And then halfway through, you have to rotate and throw your weight somewhere else, but then keep going back towards the batsman. And that's why there are bad balls. Now, somebody like Shane, for example, he biomechanically was a freak. And so his bad balls were minimal, virtually. Well, there weren't many of them at all. And Neil was great for me because I loved the way that, so what he did through the air for me was, and I only faced him a couple of times, but I remember just thinking, this guy's the best bowler I've ever faced. what he did through the air was just like, it was insanity. You don't beat a good batsman off the pitch. It's never happened. Yeah, look, they might make a mistake if they're not concentrating, but you never beat them. You never get them out. You never deceive them off the pitch. It's just their fault. You do it all through the air. And Anil Kumble, for me, is, you know, he's sort of benchmark sort of stuff. And as I said it right at the top, I don't think he gets the love that he deserves because he did it his way. He was unashamed. And by the way, very proud man and very proud Indian cricket player. And that's part of, for me, what, you know, I think he does deserve a lot more than he gets. And I'm sure, I don't live in India, and I'm sure that he does get a lot of love, but it's not enough for me because it's never enough. The guy's a genius. I think the reason that the three of us have something in common, and look, even Murali, because Murali smiled all the time, but his eyes weren't smiling. you'd think, well, no matter what you think of him or what I think of him or what anybody thinks of him in terms of his action or anything, he had to live through that, and he did. And so whether he's right or wrong, or whether we're right or we're wrong, or he worked through it and he did it, and then he won games for his country. And I think that guys who fight, you know, people might even say that it was easy for Shane, but it was definitely not easy for Shane at the beginning. He wasn't given anything when he was younger, and it wasn't his first choice of sporting profession. He wanted to be an AFL football player. So, you know, he did. That's what he wanted to be, you know. And I feel like if it's hard for you, and if you work hard, then it means more to you. They talk about it a lot in boxing, you know, that I go back to Rocky again, that eye of the tiger thing. That's right, mate. If it really matters to you when you lose, if it really matters to you that you prove to the other guy that you've beaten them, then maybe you've got an edge. And for that reason, I'm quite looking forward to it, and I hope that Mitchell Swepson plays in the Test Series for Australia, because I don't think he was necessarily the most gifted. And I've spoken to him about this, so I don't like talking about people behind their back, so there's no secrets here, but I've spoken to him. I don't think he was necessarily the most gifted bowler going around. And I don't particularly love the way he bowls in limited overs cricket, although he's getting lots of wickets. But the way that he has bowled in first-class cricket in Australia this summer, it's unbelievable. He's won games for his team on all surfaces. He has changed games. He's done it first innings, second innings. He's excited, which is also good. It's always a mistake. If you have a good day, you're allowed to be happy. But I think that he is possibly one of the guys going around at the moment that, like, because I wasn't sure that he should ever play, to be honest, but now I am. And if he doesn't play in the first test, I'll be really bummed. With Nathan Lyon, I'll be really, really disappointed. Yeah, he knows what he's doing. And I'll tell you the last time I saw it, and I'm not just saying it to you guys because we're talking to a large number of supporters from India, but Ravi Ashwin, when I watched him play overseas, so outside of India, for the first 7-8 years of his career, I just was bored. I was watching him, I'm just kind of going, well, you know, he's used to doing everything off the pitch. It's just, you know, his statistics were insane. But outside of India, I just thought, well, this is just boring bowling. And then the last time he came to Australia to play in a test series, if you remember, he just played the first test and then he got injured, unfortunately. But I watched in that first test and I'm going, hang on a second. And I don't really watch a lot of cricket now because, but I'm going, hang on. Who's spoken to him? What's going on here? This is actually working out big time because he wasn't just changing degrees of flatness and of drift and skid. He was top spin and holding him back and he bowled very, very well. And I think if he played through the entire series, last time India was in Australia, then the result would have been very, very different. But so I'm curious now to see what happens. But I think he won't have forgotten what happened. The dude, he can bowl. I'm back in his corner. So yeah.
So we have our fingers crossed for the series. Coming back to your debut and your career, Stu, you played under Mark Taylor. You played under Steve Waugh, Ricky Ponting. Now, if you look at the records, Steve Waugh is far, far ahead. Then we have Ricky Ponting and then we have Mark Taylor. How do you assess them as captains and who, according to you, was the best among the three?
Well, look, I found this out only maybe 2-3 weeks ago. It apparently, I got most of my opportunities during the period of time that Ricky was playing, was the captain. But for me, I always felt uncomfortable because I found him to be very, very structured. And when I say very, very structured, if a game plan was drawn up and agreed upon, then once we crossed the white line and walked out onto the field, that was the only way it was going to happen. And there was no variation whatsoever. Mark Taylor, on the other hand, these were my first test matches. Mark Taylor was like, the old schoolmaster, was very, very respectful, very, very polite, but always got his way. But even when he did, you thought that he was doing the best thing by you. It was almost like he held your hand the whole way through your test matches. Steve Waugh, on the other hand, is head and shoulders above anybody else in the Australian context that I played with, because he respected the individual and he understood that even if he didn't understand, provided you were all moving towards the same target, you all had the same goals, that was enough for him. And he would... Look, if I bowled rubbish, I'd have got dropped. Like that. Like, no hesitation whatsoever. But what he would do is he would say, so this is what you want to do? Are you sure? Have you considered this? Okay, cool. Let's run with your idea. And then it would be all up to you. But that level of faith really made a difference to me. And I guess I was ready for it. It was the right time in my career. If it had happened earlier or later, maybe it wouldn't have worked. But it definitely worked at the time. And I don't think we lost. I think Stephen was 76% or something stupid like that. So yeah. we did all right.
And do you think John Buchanan had a huge role to play in that? Or his role?
No, John Buchanan had a huge role to play.
Great team.
Because it's very, very important for every team to have somebody to make fun of. John Buchanan was that guy. I think that on the odd occasion that you get somebody who is so self-absorbed that they think they actually matter in a team environment, it's important to make fun of them, and I'm taking that opportunity right now.
So, Stu, you
it's have... It's okay, you can breathe now. It's okay.
So, you had played parts in... There were 16 consecutive wins, one with the Steve Waugh team and one with the Ricky Ponting team. Which win or the streak do you think was the better one?
Well, look, I'm not even sure if I played in the Ricky Ponting one. I can't remember that. But I remember that I definitely played in the Steve Waugh one. Look, I'll tell you the difference. So Steve might have been aware of the fact that we were getting close to a milestone because he was very aware of those sort of statistical events. But for the rest of us in the team, what we were all concerned about was just winning every single test match. And it wasn't every single session of every single test match, because Steve convinced us all that it didn't matter if we'd lost every single session if we won the last one. So we were only focused on getting the result at the end of that 5 days. Whereas I reckon the Ricky Ponting 16, and as I said, maybe I was a part of that, I don't know, people started to be very, very...
Yes, you were actually...
Was I? Right.
Yeah, right, in the series against West Indies, yeah. 2005, 2006.
Oh, my God, I was so old. I think during this period of time, we were very, very... Well, we were starting to be more and more concerned about how we were going as individuals, how we were going statistically, that we were getting close to a record. Look, I never played cricket for money. I never played cricket for statistics. I played cricket to beat the guy that was standing 20 metres away from me. And I wanted to beat him as many times as I could. And I wanted him to remember it when he was walking off the ground, so that the next time he walked onto the ground, he'd go, "There's that, oh, damn it, there's that guy again. He got me out last time." And that's what it was about for me. And I think that things are changing a little bit nowadays. And by the way, records are there to be broken. Don't get me wrong. I had a big fight with Mark Taylor in Pakistan when he declared the innings closed on the same score as Don Bradman. So he's 3-3-4. I had a fight with him at breakfast. I said, what are you doing that for? It's stupid, man. Like, records are there to be broken. Like he said, there's only one way we're going to win this test match. We're only going to be batting once. Like, just bat on, nail it, do whatever you got to do, and then we'll, you know, the Pakistan team will be deflated and maybe we're a chance. As it turned out, it was just a dull, boring draw. And he didn't break any records. And by the way, I'm sure he did it because he's a very nice man, Mark. He did it for the right reason. But don't subscribe to that sort of stuff. I like beating people. I like the competition. I like beating records. But I didn't play to beat records. If it happened, then that was cool. But it wasn't why I went onto the field. The reason I went onto the field was to make sure that you knew I was better than you.
Coming back to Steve Waugh once, you know, you were inadvertently part of perhaps one of the most controversial captaincy decisions Steve Waugh ever took. To this day, Warnie still holds a grudge, I guess. And I'm talking about 1999, the tour to West Indies, where Steve Waugh made the call to drop Warnie and replace him with you. You know, what were your thoughts coming into a side which was established and coming in for obviously a legend of the game? I'm sure that for you as a player, there's that added pressure of having to perform to justify that selection over Warnie.
Look, the lead up to that particular game, we'd been. Beginning of 98, we'd gone to India. It was my first Australian tour. I didn't play a test match. Then Shane was injured. I don't know if it was a shoulder or a finger. I can't remember. It's too long ago for me to remember. But he was injured. He was out. We went to Pakistan. So I played as the first pick spin bowler. It was the first tour that we'd won in Pakistan in 38 years. I did well. I was happy. I got 9 wickets in one of the test matches. Don't remember. Maybe Rawalpindi, maybe. Had a great tour. Enjoyed it. And actually really did enjoy the tour as well. It was great. It was a great time. Then came back to Australia. We played an Ashes tour. Was the leading wicket taker in the Ashes tour, the Ashes summer. Warnie came back from injury in that last test match, which was in Sydney. I got 12, he got 2. Then we went to the West Indies. As far as I'm concerned, because I think he is the best wrist spinner of all time, certainly in my best wrist spinner in my time. And I'm going to rephrase one more time with respect to Anil, the best conventional wrist spinner during my time. No, because as I mentioned to you before, it's very important to me because I think, as I said, Anil Kumble needs to be
revered.
If it's the last thing that I do, I'm going to talk about him until the day I drop. He's right up there. But as far as I'm concerned, Shane Warne was still injured when we went to the West Indies. We're playing against Brian Lara. And Lara has huge arguments about this all over the world because, you know, Sachin's obviously very, very special. But in terms of devastation, through the eyes of a spin bowler, the most devastating player of spin bowling during my time was Brian Lara. It was a lot harder to get Sachin out. He he would dominate in a different way. But what Brian would do is Brian would try and take you out of the attack and try and make sure that you weren't in a fit mental state to play the next game. He'd try and just destroy you. It was complete and utter destruction. And so that was pretty hard work. And in my opinion, when we went to the Caribbean that year, Shane was injured. He was recovering from a potentially career-threatening injury. And when I was selected in front of him for that last test, I wasn't selected in front of him because I'd been playing the previous three tests. Colin Miller was picked in front of him. And I just felt that he'd been forced in to playing almost because they were trying to rush him back into the picture because he was so dominating, you know. Look, in that final test match, we needed to win it to retain the Frank Worrell Trophy. I got 6 wickets. We did. End of story. Then Shane went on to play in the very next game for Australia, which was in the World Cup, and we won the World Cup. So in my opinion, Australia won twice. That's it.
Makes sense. You know, looking back at your career, you didn't have the benefit of continuously playing. There was a lot of starts and stops just because of the fact that Australia didn't always, you know, want to play two spinners, and Warney would usually be the first selection. Do you think that this, you know, how difficult was it to kind of just get dropped into the side randomly when say Warne was not fit, and how difficult was it to perform at a high level when you don't have that consistency of selection regularly?
I think everybody's got their strengths and weaknesses, obviously. Probably the thing that I was best at was turning on. It's time. I knew that the only way that I was going to get selected in the first place was by taking wickets. And then the only way that I was going to continue to be selected was by taking wickets that contributed to my team winning. So you don't have to take all the wickets, okay? But you got to make sure your team wins. And that's predominantly by taking wickets as quickly as you possibly can so that your batsmen have enough time to make the runs. I never really minded being in and out. Sometimes, a couple of times, I felt I just didn't think I'd ever play again, which was a little bit deflating because I thought I was good enough. But, you know, imagine being the second best wicket keeper in Australia. It doesn't, you know, at least as a bowler, there's a chance that they'll always play two of you, you know, or three or four or five. But wicketkeepers, it's you get one or the other, you know. So I certainly didn't feel unlucky. You know, we mentioned my grandfather and my father before. So I'd grown up respecting the achievements of guys who played a lot fewer test matches than I did. I never felt unlucky for playing one test match a year. you know, there's a whole bunch of people who only played one test match. So, I get to play one every year. That's not such a big... I do think, however, that it is a skill that is possibly overlooked about preparing for a match. it's a lot easier to be disappointed than it is to be underprepared.
Makes sense. You know, speaking about, you know, selection, is it strange to you that Australia, which, you know, kind of pioneered this attacking mindset in test cricket, the 300 to 400 in a day, 100 in a first session of a test match, going for the kill always. Is it surprising to you that they didn't consider to playing two leg spinners more often? Because perhaps that is the most attacking bowling attack you could take onto the field, playing two leg spinners at the same time.
So a lot of people ask me, you know, if I'm disappointed that I didn't play in a different era. You know, am I disappointed that I played at the same time as Shane Warne? I'm not disappointed about that at all. I feel very, very lucky to have played at the same time as Shane Warne. I am very, and I, with respect to everybody who's watching, I won't use the language that's bouncing around inside my head at the moment. But I am absolutely convinced that had Shane and I played together twice as much, three times as much, nobody's beating us. We played a game against the rest of the world after the 05 Ashes in Sydney. Yeah. And everybody to this day ridicules the game, just says it was a joke of a game. It's nothing. The guys didn't care. No, Shane Warne had just come off 40 wickets in the Ashes series, 20 wickets in the first innings, 20 wickets in the second innings of an Ashes series in England. I'd just come off the same Ashes tour, not having been given a game. So I was spinning. I was like, you didn't want to walk in front of my car at that time. Let's put it that way. Look, I think I got 9 or 10 and he got 8 or 9 in the test match. In the same test match, Muralitharan and Vittori were playing. They got nothing. We, Warnie and I, got 17 or 18 of the 20 wickets in the test. And Australia just absolutely crushed the rest of the world team. You might say, okay, perhaps the guys from the rest of the world team were on tour. They were trying to have a good time. They were, you know, you're trying to tell me that Sehwag and Tendulkar and Dravid and like callous to what they didn't care.
Muralitharan.
Come on, man. You know, and I use that match as an example. If we had played together more often, sometimes I would have got the wickets, sometimes Shane would have got the wickets, but I guarantee you we wouldn't have lost.
Interesting. It's an interesting thought. You talked about, you know, how if you both had played, things would have been much different. And that takes me to, you know, to talk about you touring India. You know, in 2001, you didn't get a test match. I, for example, obviously also coming back from what you just said, wouldn't have been ideal, for example, to have two spinners play in India. And that didn't happen.
So in 2001, I didn't even get to tour. I toured in 1998, which, you know, and subsequent to that, they just didn't take me. I think they tried a bunch of different spin bowlers. Nathan Horitz went, Cameron White went. And that hurt me a bit because I just thought, like, I remember Trevor Holmes, who is obviously a great mate of John Buchanan's, who's the chairman of selectors at the moment in Australia. He said to me, well, you know, Warnie doesn't get wickets over there, so, you know, why should you? Well, we're different. we bowled differently. On the 98 tour, I played one game. Obviously, it wasn't a test match, but it was against the, I don't know, the chairman's 11 or something like that. And I got 5 wickets in the first innings. That's the only time I played in India. Only time. You've got to give somebody a go. If you don't give them a go, then I'm actually in favour massively in going, mate, gave you the opportunity. See you later.
Yeah.
You're finished. But, mate, Michael Clarke can get 6 for 3. I'm pretty sure I can get a couple of poles out of there.
That's interesting. That's interesting. So moving on then a bit, you know, talking about, you know, matches that you did play for. So talk us through the batsmen. So which were the hardest to, for example, get out?
So, I mean, that's a good question because, as I mentioned to you before, Brian Lara was a devastating wrecking ball, okay? I played, so went to India in 98, had the opportunity to meet a couple of the guys, became very friendly with Rahul Dravid. He looked after me, a wonderful guy. Saurav, the same, great that they were looking after me. But I played against them and I just thought, well, you know, I've got them out before so I can do that. It's not a big deal for me. I played against Rahul a couple of times in Australia on tours that I wasn't participating in Australian colours. It was New South Wales versus, you know, knocked him over, no biggie. But then I think it was 2003.
Yeah.
So he came to Australia and I got him out of not heaps, but maybe 3 or 4 times, maybe 4 or 5, maybe in first class games. And so I wasn't particularly bothered by bowling to him. I am telling you now, I could not, for the life of me, work out how to get him out. Now, partly that might be my fault because I was focusing on, because at the time, Saurav was known as being the best player of spin bowling in the world. So I was focusing a lot on him. Lakshman is a freak. So I was concentrating on him. And I just thought, well, I've got Rahul out before and I'm not going to worry about it too much. Couldn't get him out. I remember even in a couple of games, Adelaide particularly, where he just, you know, I remember just thinking, I don't really know what to do next. And it wasn't even a case of, because he was more patient than I was, because I'm not a patient man. So I remember thinking, there's no point me just running in and doing the same thing and doing the same thing and doing the same thing. Because it's not going to work. Because he's going to wait longer than I do. And I'm done. Lakshman different. I'd become friendly with him the year before when he played club cricket in Sydney. And he's a nice man. And that's kind of annoying as well. So it's like, you couldn't even hate him. It's like, oh, come on. Like, at least I could, you know. But it was a very interesting tour for me. And I think in terms of trying to get people out, those two were possibly, look, I did manage to pick up Lakshman a couple of times on that tour. And part of that, well, my favourite test of the whole tour was at the MCG. And I think I may have even got him out in both innings. But that was the highlight. Wasn't my best return in my test career. I didn't even get 5 wickets. But that was, it made me feel so tall and so proud. And I just felt like $1 million. That was a pretty big deal. I can't think of anybody else in world cricket apart from Rahul on that tour. Even, you know, like Sangakkara, Lara, you know, Michael Vaughan, maybe, on the last tour that he made to Australia. He was hard work, but early on I got him out as well. So maybe that's the, actually, maybe that's the same mindset. So because I'd got him out before, I wasn't as concerned going in. But then he, because he'd evolved the same way as Rahul had evolved. But there's not many people, because for me, once I got somebody out once, I could go back to the top of my mark and feel okay. I wasn't scared, because if you can get somebody out once, it means you can get them out again. But it wasn't always true, unfortunately.
Right.
I mean, I'm not just saying, and by the way, I'm not just saying this because we're talking to a predominantly Indian audience. Okay. Like, no, I really need to make that very clear, because,
sure.
Because if I think of all of the players, another one actually is David Boone. I played against him when he was playing for Tasmania. Now, he didn't smash me, but I couldn't get him out. And then, so in my opinion, my job as a bowler is to get you out. And as I mentioned before, to get you out as quickly as I possibly can so the batsmen have enough time to make the runs. Boone, exactly the same. Soft hands. Didn't play a shot. And then, because my job is to get you out, I'd try something different. Short ball four, no problems. And he just kind of look at me. And I go, damn it, I fell for it again.
What to do next?
What do you do? So, but there, I can count on one hand the number of players who, because it's one thing to smash the living daylights out of a spin bowler. It's another thing to prove to a bowler that if you don't want to get out, they can't do anything about it.